I'll never forget, Bobby Watson gave me this book by Mark Levine called The Jazz Piano Book, just to borrow, so I could just like sit down and really start learning the craft. And I guess I must have advanced, you know, just so much within that little pocket of time that he autographed it for me.
That's Desmond Mason. I'm Jamie Green. And this is Trading Fours.
I'm going to Kansas City.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Trading Fours. I'm your host, Jamie Green. Hope you're doing well. I'm just back from a whirlwind trip to my hometown of Lincoln, Nebraska, where I played a gig, a full rock show for the first time indoors in at least 15 months. That was great. In fact, highly recommend the people up in Lincoln at Gray's Cake Saloon. They're great to work with. They have their own PA. They have their own sound guy. They have their own lights. They treat you nice. Not that hard to treat bands nice, man. It really isn't. So thanks to them, and I won't get into the rant, but Airbnb sucks. I mean, it sucks so bad. Do not use Airbnb. Anyway. All right, that's the end of my rant on that. Hey, today I've got the amazing piano player, keyboard player, producer, beat maker, Desmond Mason. Desmond, I became aware of him because last year I was working on a Christmas tune and I need some help on the keyboard part. And somebody had done something I didn't really like. And I was like, this didn't work. So I was talking to Paula Saunders, who's been a guest. She was actually the vocalist on that track. And she said, I got a guy for you. This guy is amazing. He's brilliant. And for somebody who's as talented and powerful singer and just amazing as Paula Saunders to say that, I was instantly intrigued, and that person turned out to be Desmond Mason, and guess what? He crushed it. It was amazing. So really was so happy to talk to Desmond. He's a really good guy, and learned a lot from this one. So it's always good to get, you know, different perspectives on different parts of music that I'm not familiar with. So we're going to delve into the beat world, because I literally knew nothing about it. And he was a good egg. He indulged me. We learned a lot. So you're really going to dig this one. Desmond's an amazing guy. Let's get started. Here's my conversation with Desmond Mason. Well, Desmond, thanks so much for being on Trading Fours. And I became aware of you because of Paula Saunders, and you helped out on a Christmas track that was fabulous. I really love what you did for me on that. And I think a good place to start is you got on the news all over the Kansas City Star and all over the place because was it International Music Day that you were performing up on the top of Liberty Memorial?
Yes. Yeah.
So
yeah.
How did this happen? How did somebody pitch to you, hey, Desmond, you want to get up with a keyboard and go to the top of Liberty Memorial? I'm curious how this all broke down.
Generally I'm very involved with the Mutual Musicians Foundation on 19th Highland. I'm actually one of the board members. And the secretary, James McGee, texted me one day and said, yo, like Casio is giving away a keyboard if you do this performance on top of the Liberty Memorial. So of course I said yes, like within seconds of said request, and I got the keyboard from Casio. It turned out to be a keyboard that I tried out at NAMM 2 years ago, so okay. I was already familiar with it. I was one of the 20 or so musicians chosen to perform with that keyboard in the most crazy places in America. Yeah.
It seemed like it was very windy up there.
Extremely windy. Extremely windy.
And the mayor was there.
Yeah.
How was that?
I guess I was so focused on the performance that, you know, I really didn't feel nervousness or anything of that nature when performing in front of them. But it's definitely a bucket list item, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. So for my day job, I do public policy work. So I've actually known Quentin, who's the mayor of Kansas City, for people who don't know, for a number of years. And it's I know he's a huge sports fan because he's always talking about the Chiefs and the Royals and all that stuff. But I didn't know he was into music much. So did he dig it?
Oh, he dug it very much, I believe. Got to perform an encore for him as well. I think he really enjoyed himself. And yeah.
That's cool, man. How many people get to do something like that? Right?
Like I said, it's a bucket list item. I never thought that I would have been the person to do something like play a pretty much private concert 200 feet in the air.
Right.
But I was the person that got to do it. So for that, you know, I'm very thankful.
Is that the weirdest gig you've ever played?
By far. Yes, by far.
We did the streetcar gig 2 years ago for the holidays.
Uh-huh.
And that was weird because, I mean, it was really fun, but it was, I've never played on a moving, you know, object the whole, and we did it for like 2 hours, and it almost got like, I couldn't like stare down at my hands or feet or look at something too intently because I started getting a little motion sickness.
Wow.
So I had to make sure I kept my head up and like watched things, but people loved it. Like people were like way into it. I think they weren't expecting when they got on the streetcar that, you know, there was going to be live musicians playing. So it was
fun. Yes. See, I'm the opposite. I think I would have liked to play on the streetcar more than the Liberty Memorial, but that's only because I'm afraid of heights.
Okay. Yeah, that's a problem then.
So you know, I was kind of using my, you know, adrenaline and my fear to kind of push me forward in that moment, you know, just thinking about the music. But I would have definitely appreciated the streetcar more. Not saying that the Liberty Memorial wasn't a great experience, because again, it was a great experience and it was a bucket list experience, and I probably wouldn't do it again.
Well, the good news for you, Desmond, is the woman who runs all the PR for the streetcar is a friend of mine. So I'll hook you up when we get done with the interview and do an introduction. Maybe you can do the streetcar this next Christmas. How about that?
Awesome. That would be great.
So I'm real curious, since you're on the musicians, the Mutual Foundation board, you're the first person I've talked to about this. You're going to be like episode 75. This is a really cool organization with a very storied history in Kansas City. So Desmond, can you kind of tell people about it?
The Mutual Musicians Foundation is one of only two historical landmarks besides the Liberty Memorial in Kansas City. It's been around since the start of jazz. Some of the greatest acts in jazz history have been through the place. You know, we're talking Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Jay McShann, Charlie Parker got his start, you know, or part of his start, like within the place. Definitely a tour stop for musicians of color as they were touring through the Midwest and through the rest of the nation. So a lot of great music, a lot of great history have went through that place, that little building on 18th, 19th and Highland.
Yeah. And it's interesting that it's not just something that's a historical place and like, you know, hey, this is what happened, but the jam night is a very storied thing, a very late at night jam night. So tell people about that that weren't aware of it.
Every Saturday and Sunday morning, we technically call it like Friday night, Saturday night, but it's really 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. every Saturday and Sunday morning, where there's a house band and we just get together and play jazz for 4 hours. And, you know, any competent musician, you know, can come up and jam with us as well. I believe we are definitely the only jam session that goes till 5 a.m. in the morning.
Well, that's the two reasons why I haven't done it. One, I'm not a competent musician. And two, it's way too late.
I mean, you did a good job on that Christmas song.
No,
so,
I'm all right, dude.
I wouldn't say you're not a competent musician now.
No, you're very sweet. No, I'm fine. I'm a hobby. Like, I'm fine. If it's rock and roll, I feel pretty good about it. But jazz is a whole nother vocabulary. It's a whole other language. It's, you know, right? It's completely. In fact, though, I Bobby Harris of the Daz Band, who's been on the podcast, he's actually one of my wife's friends has been his partner forever and stuff. So Bobby wants to do this at some point. And he's like, oh, come, we should do it and come. And I was like, I'll go down there with you and watch. And you can play. But I'll have to take two naps that day, right?
Yeah, I usually take a nap right before I have to go. So yeah. I can stay up throughout the night.
So for people who don't know, and one of the ideas of this podcast is to talk about the rich history of music in Kansas City. And this is a very storied thing, like back when you were talking about Jay McShann and Charlie Parker and Lester Young and all those guys. So when they were here in town playing, that was one of the reasons why they got so good, because they could play all night long, right? They could go until the sun came up and play.
Right, right. And the Musician Foundation, you know, kind of functioned as like an incubator, like for ideas too, you know, where musicians can hang around other musicians, especially, you know, Black musicians, most definitely, you know, can hang around each other, work on the music, develop with one another, develop bands with one another. You know, there was a lot of, you know, band hopping like back in the day too. Where the McShann band might exchange members, like with the Basie band, for example. Like, I can't remember specifically off the top of my head, but if anyone were to read like the history of Charlie Parker or the history of Kansas City Jazz by Chuck Haddix, you know, that's another good reference. You know, it'll explain all of that in detail. Like was said, the foundation was definitely, you know, just a great historical place and a great place where this music actually developed with all the luminaries that you just named.
Yeah. It'd be cool to get in a time machine and see it in person, wouldn't it?
Oh, most definitely.
Right.
Most definitely.
No, absolutely. Well, let's talk about you specifically. So, like I said, I've heard you play, I got to see you play live, you know, COVID kind of knocked everything out. I didn't get to see anybody for a long time, but I got to see you play and, you're fabulous. So you personally, like, what age did you start and who kind of was, what was the impetus for you? Somebody in the family or you heard somebody? What made you want to play the keyboard?
I formally started like age 17, 18, actually in high school. I mean, I started music in elementary school, first starting on the violin, actually, and I got pretty good at it. But I always wanted to play the piano. You know, I was at Raytown South Middle School for a little bit, and I would just sit in on these jazz band rehearsals, right? And they would just be playing all this cool stuff like Smoke on the Water and some other great jazz tunes. And I said, yo, it would be very cool if, you know, I played keyboard one day. So I go up to the teacher, her name is Miss Keck, you know, God bless her. She also taught me orchestra too. She was actually my first music teacher, but she was the jazz band director as well. And I went up and asked her, and I was like, you know, how can I play piano like in the jazz band? This was in sixth grade. And then she said, unless you take piano lessons, like you really can't. And I was like, oh man. So things happened, and I wasn't really able to do music again until like late in high school, like I said, 17, 18. And, I was fiddling around on the piano one day in church, and a couple of people saw my talent, you know, Dr. Nelson and Ann Johnson, will never forget them. And they ended up, you know, supporting me by getting me into classical piano lessons. And I ended up taking a couple of years of lessons at the Community Music and Dance Academy. So that's how I got started in piano. And then they got me into jazz camp with Bobby Watson.
Yeah.
Around that time as well. And I was in college for history. You know, I failed my music audition. You know, I thought I was good enough to get into the conservatory, but apparently I wasn't. But around that time, I got into jazz camp with Bobby Watson, and I was still a beginner, all that jazz. And, I'll never forget, Bobby Watson gave me this book by Mark Levine called The Jazz Piano Book, just to borrow, so I could just like sit down and really start learning the craft. And I guess I must have advanced, you know, just so much within that little pocket of time that he autographed it for me, told me to keep learning the science, and actually gave it to me. And I still have it to this day. And I pretty much, and you know what? I pretty much used that book, you know, not only for the info within it, but it also has a good bibliography of just like famous jazz records that you should listen to.
Right.
So me being at UMKC, I would just take that bibliography and just check out CDs like from the library, and then just burn them onto my computer. And then I would just listen to them for hours on end, you know, just trying to learn the craft. And really ever since then, I really haven't taken any formal lessons. It's just all ear training. It's just all studying. It's just all getting into that book and other jazz theory books, just to learn as much of the craft as possible. And now, as I am here today, you know, that's a byproduct of all of that. So that's how I got to where I am.
Well, that's a great story. So for people who don't know, Bobby Watson has been at UMKC for what, 20 years, but he is a phenomenal jazz musician who actually played with the Jazz Messengers, Art Blakey's group. And if you want to do like jazz, you want to go backwards in time with jazz history, I mean, Art Blakey was playing with like people like Monk in New York. I mean, these heavyweights of jazz. So that's, I mean, Kansas City really scored a coup when they got Bobby to come back to Kansas City and be a teacher. And you're like the fourth or fifth person that I've had on that has Bobby stories about what an impact he made on their lives.
Oh yeah. I got a couple of other Bobby stories where he's embarrassed me in public, but it was for good reason. Like at one jam session, you know, he just showed up, right? And I was on piano. And I never forget this. I was on piano, and he calls "Take the A Train" now by Duke Ellington. So mm-hmm. Now, if you've listened to 99% of the versions of "Take the A Train," it has the specific intro up front. It goes and then it goes into the tune. Mm-hmm. Now, me being green behind the ears back then, I did not play that intro. I just pedaled, you know, on the five. You know, I just played a G sus 7 chord, you know, just for all the musicians up there. And then Bobby just like goes up to the stand and is like, "No, no, 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 stop, stop." And then he gets me off the piano. He sits at the piano and he says, "Yo, the intro is this." And then he lets me back on the piano. I've never played the intro wrong ever again.
How many people were there? How many people got to see this?
A good number.
So were you just mortified at the time?
Yes, I was. I was. But again, you know, when Bobby kind of goes off on you in public like that, it's kind of a good lesson. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely a lesson that, you know, I've taken with me ever since. Like, I've never gotten the intro wrong on that tune ever again after that.
Well, I assume you know the whole Joe Jones story with Bird. You know that story?
Oh, that's one of the stories I don't know. Enlighten me.
So apparently, and this is, you know, whether this actually happened or it's just become jazz folklore, I don't know, but I've read it in 3 or 4 different books. So apparently when Bird was playing and he was playing and he went off on some like huge solo and stuff and kind of like was so into it, he wasn't paying attention to what the rest of the band was doing. And Joe Jones, who people who don't know, was a fabulous drummer who played with tons of people.
Yeah.
Took his cymbal off, you know, unscrewed it and picked it up and threw it out on the dance floor, and it came crashing down and it startled Parker, and then everything was completely silent, and it just like embarrassed the crap out of him apparently. And that's what made him kind of slink off. And that's why he went down to the Ozarks and like woodshedded for like months and months and months. And then when he came back, it's like where he had that breakthrough.
Oh,
like he wasn't the same cat. Like he was like this phenomenal player all the time. So probably at the time he hated what happened to him because it's embarrassing. Right. But the outcome out of it was, It really inspired him to like get to work and be like, "No, you're not going to do that to me again." So anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yes, sir.
That's funny. Oh, I'd love to have Bobby on. So when you see Bobby, tell him if he wants to talk to a schmo.
Look me up. I will.
So Desmond, let's talk about who are the keyboard players that you love?
First and foremost, Bill Evans. Bill Evans is definitely the top piano player. I also enjoy McCoy Tyner. I also enjoy Herbie Hancock. Robert Glasper, most definitely. Let's see what else. I think those are pretty much the main four that I would pull up, you know, if I were in the car one day or if I'm just listening to records at home. It's definitely one of those four. Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite the list. Herbie Hancock does not age. I don't know what he's doing, but he looks like he's about 45 years old still.
It must be that good meditation that he practices every day. It
must be something. So what about Bill Evans?
Oh, what about him? I mean,
it's interesting to me just because, how do I say this? Bill Evans is white, right? So
yeah,
a lot of people wouldn't be like, does he swing? I don't know. Anyway, the rest of those guys, like, yeah, McCoy Tyner and, you know, all those guys, I think, but the Bill Evans thing intrigues me. What about Bill Evans?
Well, Herbie Hancock's foremost influence is Bill Evans, actually.
Okay.
Bill Evans, I mean, there were two moments in my life that really spurred me to fall in love with jazz.
Okay.
Number one was hearing this old take of Just Squeeze Me by Duke Ellington and his orchestra. You know, it just swung so hard and I was like, wow, I want to play music like this, right? I mean, this is later in life, you know what I'm saying? This is not the sixth grade me in the jazz band room. Like, yo, this is cool. You know, this is me with more mature ears. You know, and I first listened to that record and you know, I just never forgot the feeling that I felt. Now, the second moment was I was in Atlanta for a church conference and I'll never forget it. And I was just looking to buy like some jazz record. You know, I didn't know what I was looking for, but I was in the record store and I bought Bill Evans' Waltz for Debbie, one of the live records that he did at the Village Vanguard.
Right.
And when those first notes of My Foolish Heart came in, it was just so sublime to me. Like, whoa, like, what is this? It's so relaxing and the chords that he was playing, you know, just so crystal clear. It was just beautiful. It was just so beautiful. So
that's great. I mean, I love Bill Evans, so.
After listening to that record a million times, you know, I said, hey, let me get into, you know, some of the other stuff, you know, that he did, you know, let me, you know, research him some more. And I think the number one thing that I love about him is that he was just so different from everyone else.
Yeah.
And to reference that, you know, if I were to show this to somebody else, I would just pull up this YouTube video of him, Patrice Rushen, Mary McPartlin, and I forgot the other pianist's name. The other pianist was in the Modern Jazz Quartet, but they have four pianists playing Billy's Bells, right? And the other three were great, you know what I'm saying? Like the other three pianists were great, but when Bill like came in and did his solo, it was just like a 180 from everyone else. And that resulted from him, much like Charlie Parker, you know, there was just one or two summers in which, you know, he just sat down outside of the scene and just developed his sound. And then when he came back, you know, with his debut album and all of that, like he just took the world by storm because it was just so different. It's just so different. So, I can't say enough about Bill Evans. Like,
no, that's great.
Think,
you know,
I think he's one of the goats.
No, I that's great. And I think that's so true. You know, it's really interesting. I'm actually reading a biography of Thelonious Monk right now. And one of the funniest things to read are the original reviews, like in Downbeat, like his first, like, and they hate him. They just hate him. And I'm sure it's the same with any of those guys who are iconoclasts that like kind of forge ahead and push the envelope and make music you know, different. And now it's like, it's a jazz standard. Like everybody, you know, Straight No Chaser, everybody in the planet that plays any jazz, you know, that Around Midnight or any of those tunes, like there's jazz standards. Like everybody has to know how to play the songs. But at the time, they're like, oh, he's playing the wrong chords. You know, he doesn't know what he's doing. It's just like this, you know, and it's always those stuffy jerks that are like the critics who probably are just failed musicians themselves that are throwing the shade on it. So whether it's him or Bill Evans or Parker or whoever, it's just interesting to see at the time how they're originally received. And it seems like the musicians are the ones that figure it out first and embrace it first. And then eventually the critics come around.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, that's just what happens. Well, you were very kind to send me a couple tracks. And so I want to talk about these. So let's first talk about Grown Folks.
Uh-huh.
So how did you get, so this is a cool tune and I'll have it on the open so people can hear it when I introduce you.
Uh-huh.
So first of all, what was the what was the inspiration to write it? And then second of all, how did you get hooked up to have it in a Jägermeister ad?
Wow. It's interesting. Many people have asked me what mind space I was in when I made that, because usually most of the music production that I do is really orchestral, is really real instrument based, you know, if that makes sense, you know, a lot of like acoustic pianos, you know, electric bass, you know, all of that, you know, I just try to make my music as realistic as possible, but it's all me. With Grown Folks, it's just really a funky future bass sort of number. It you know, one day I just sat down and tried to find the most unique sounds possible, and I pretty much threw it together, and it's been doing quite good for me. Now the Jägermeister situation, a couple of years ago, I went out to Los Angeles to do a production showcase, and I ended up winning said showcase, but I also made a connection out there with Glenn McRae. Never forget him. At that time, he was working for Netflix. He was one of the, you know, rights people for Netflix, i.e., you know, music rights,
right.
You know, yeah. You know, syncs and all that. So mm-hmm. He believed in my talent. And when this COVID situation, you know, started, he was trying to, you know, get the talented producers that he knew, like opportunities, you know, for syncs. And the Jägermeister sync like came up and he recommended me. So I ended up, you know, doing the application and Grown Folks got accepted. And now is in ads on social media, mainly on Instagram, you know, and they pretty much featured, you know, making drinks with Jägermeister with my music in the background. It's so cool though. Like just to get an ad with a big company like that. So.
Sure. Well, especially like you said, you probably didn't get to do much during COVID because the whole world shut down. So as a musician, you need to make money.
Yeah.
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 That made me a good amount. So
good. Well, you need
really
that.
Appreciate it.
All right. So here's the second thing. So, well, there's twofold here. So I'm a guitar player mostly. I play a little bit of piano, not like you, but I actually started on piano first. But I'm a guitar player to begin with. And second, I'm 53 years old, right? So
okay.
I'm a lot older than you. And so I am completely intrigued by the stuff that you do with beats, but I understand none of it. So,
wow.
So, because my generation, you know, I grew up in the 70s, 80s, and very early 90s was when I first became an adult. So this is a whole different era.
Right.
Of music. It just wasn't, I mean, the only thing that was popular that was like hip hoppy even then was like Beastie Boys and Run DMC, like a long time ago, like way far. I mean, we play Sabotage in my 90s band, but that's about the extent of the stuff that I listen to.
Right.
So this is the whole catalog stuff that I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. So It's good to have you on because I always want to learn. So tell me about how you got into it. Tell me about these competitions. How does all this work?
Oh, wow. I first started getting into producing summer of 2015. I was just laid off from Park University, you know, at that time. So, you know, without a job, you know, I said to myself, like, do I want to dive into music like full time? Like music, even though I got a history degree from UMKC, music has always been the thing that I've always wanted to do, like no matter what. So at that time, I just made the decision to jump into it. So as part of that decision, I used some of the severance money that I got to buy me a new pair of studio monitors. I also got this program called Cubase from the Yamaha Motif synthesizer that I bought, you know, just a gig. So I downloaded that onto the computer and I say, you know what? Let me just try this, you know, beat making music production thing. And of course, I sucked at it at first. But through doing showcases like with iStandard, through doing online beat battles, through doing like other showcases, other sample flip competitions, I ended up getting better and better and better as I applied the feedback that I got. Now I've won 15 big beat battles in my career and numerous other opportunities. So okay. It's been a journey.
So these beat battles. So is it just, is it like the US Open? You just get paired against somebody and if you keep advancing until it's over? Or how does
this work? Yep. That's how it works.
Are there people there watching this, Desmond? How does that work?
At the live beat battles, best believe, yes. The last big beat battle that I did was back in May, I believe. It was in St. Louis. It was called the Fresh Produce St. Louis Beat Battle. It was a tournament of 8 producers. I ended up winning it, but it was in the big shopping center, like right outside of Busch Stadium. Okay. It was supposed to be outside. Right outside of Busch Stadium, like, but I mean, like, you had Jumbotrons in there, you had mad people in there. The energy was thick, you know. And then the last big beat battle I did before that, I started a Beast of the Beats in Miami in December 2019. That was a tournament of about 80 producers from all over the world. I mean, you got people from London, from California, from Texas, all of that. And I ended up winning that. And it was a racket every single night. Like full crowd in the club with the subs and with the speakers going. Yeah, it's pretty much a big deal when it comes to these, you know, crowds and energy, you know, at these big beat battles, you know, especially pre-COVID and now. We're getting back to normal. So now we're returning to that. And I really can't wait. So.
Well, you're going to have to send me a link. I have to watch this. I'm curious. And if it's ever in Kansas City, let me know. Cause I'll come out. Cause I'm curious. Like I said, I'm always interested in like things about music. I don't know. And I don't understand. Like I'm always wanting to learn.
Right.
So this is something that I think it would be. And my wife loves people watching and she loves to dance. So she'll be all over this. Like,
Wow. So, awesome. So I'll let you know.
Yeah, dude, man. So do you get like work then? I'm guessing if you win one of these things, then people are like, well, this guy knows what he's doing. Do you like hear from musicians that want to work with you or have you produced something? How does that, is there anything like that that comes out of it?
A whole lot of that comes out of it, actually. You know, people will ask you like for your social media, for your number, that they will hit you up. And also, like, if big producers are watching, you know, they'll definitely hit you up as well. Currently, I am signed to Kool & Dre, to Epidemic Music. Kool & Dre, they are 2-time Grammy winners as far as his music production game. And I first met Kool at Beast of the Beats in 2019, you know, in Miami. Like, he just finals. So, you know, right after finals, I was supposed to, you know, collaborate like on a record with him, but, you know, things didn't work out. He was supposed to fly me back out, but then COVID happened. But it was kind of a blessing that COVID happened because, you know, he started doing these online shows on Instagram where he just submit beats, you know, and he'll listen and, you know, he'll do critiques. And for a couple of months, I just kept on sending him beats, and he just kept hearing the name D-Dot Professor. You know, that's my production moniker, by the way, D-Dot Professor. And he realized that all of them were quality. So fast forward, you know, he calls me and he says, do you want to be a part of the team? And I said, sure. And now I'm part of the team. So a lot of things come out of beat battles. You know, like I mentioned earlier, you know, people will ask you for your number. People will ask for your social media. They will hit you up for music production and you might get a big deal out of it. So I've gotten a couple of big deals out of beat battles, actually. That's why I love doing them.
They should do a reality show about this.
They already do.
Okay.
And it's called The House of Beats. They have this reality show. I think it takes place in Houston, Texas. And they pretty much pick 8 producers to live in a house for about a week. and they just throw all sorts of challenges at you. Like,
yeah, they got to gin up the drama, right? Like they can't right. make it easy, right?
Right, right. You know, like one of the challenges on the first season was like, if your life depended on it, like what beat would you play? Another challenge was, you know, using another program that you don't use to make a beat. So like I use Persona Studio One. It's like that challenge would have me go on Pro Tools, for example, to make a beat. I don't know how to use Pro Tools, like, to be honest. So I'll be lost. And a lot of people were lost in that challenge. So yeah, they have a reality show. I think season 2 is about to come out shortly. One of my Epidemic Music teammates, Westerfer from Chicago, got on the show. So I can't wait to watch it. You know, I wanted it to get on the show, but I guess I've missed the application deadline. But maybe I'll be on season 3. But they definitely have reality shows about this stuff. Remy Martin, that's another big production competition. They don't do it reality show like, but they do take a lot of background footage about you. So it's kind of like a reality show, but it's still a beat battle at the same time. They just do a whole lot of, you know, post-production, so to speak, you know, as they're presenting it to the world. So
no, that's great. Thank you for indulging me, because, you know, like I said, I knew nothing. So it's always good to learn new things. So I'll put in the show notes where to find you. You said D-Dot Professor is all your social media. So I'll put all those links in there so people can find you. And I think a good place to kind of, so with the world opening up, Desmond, what are your plans for 2021? You're going to want to gig out a lot. You wanted to do beat battles a lot. You want to do it all. What's your plans?
I want to do it all plus travel more.
Where do you want to go to?
Well, I'm going to Denver in July, and then I'm going to Omaha in July. But other than that, probably a few more trips to LA, most definitely. I think I'm going to want to travel to LA and Atlanta the most, because I got music producer colleagues in Atlanta. You know, that would allow me to get work done. Same thing with LA as well. I got connections in LA as well. It's all about the connections that you got, like within this like music production game, within music in general. You know, it's all about your network. And I just want to travel more to enjoy life and to just, you know, take advantage of the network that I got.
That's great. I'll actually be in LA in about a month. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Need to get out of Kansas City for a while, dude.
Business
been here
pleasure?
A lot. Pleasure. We have a lot of friends and family out there. So
awesome. Palm trees.
You know, I've been beaches. In Kansas City for the last 16 months. I want to go somewhere. I mean, I love it here, but it'd be nice to have a change of scenery, right?
Right.
That's funny. So let's to wrap it up. Another good thing. So who do you love to play with here in town? And it doesn't mean only play with, but just some of the people you just like, oh, when you're like, you're going to do a show and they're on the bill with you and you're like, oh, this is going to be fun. Who are some of the people you love to play with?
Oh, wow. Charging to my mind if I admit you.
Yeah. Not an exclusive list, just some.
Okay, not an exclusive list. Some people. Paula Saunders, mm-hmm. most definitely. Amber Flutie Nastiness Underwood. You know, we've had a working relationship for a while now. Church Boy on drums and vocals. Tim Ogotu on guitar and bass guitar. Zach Morrow, Walt Beeson, Brian Alford, most definitely on drums and steel pans. DeAndre Manning on bass. Brian Stever on drums. Brad Williams on drums, Kevin Young on bass, Chalice O'Neill on trumpet, Ernest Melton whenever he's in town now because he's been in Florida forever on tenor sax, Steve Lambert, too many to name.
Well, you know, I think that's good though, because one of the things that I mean, part of the reason of this podcast is I really wanted to tout all the music that's in this town. You know, I think there's this idea if you come from outside of Kansas City that, well, first of all, you think it's in, you know, in the middle of a cornfield because you're an idiot. So you don't know that it's a city, a metro area of 2.5 million people, right?
Right.
But the other thing too is that I always say the best way to honor the jazz history of the city is to go out and support musicians now. And, you know, because maybe the next great musician's already here, right? You know, it's fine to go to, I mean, I'm not against, go to the Jazz Museum if you haven't been, support all that stuff too. But really the way that it really works is if it's a living history where you mm-hmm. go out and experience the music in person. That's the way that you really honor what we have here. So I
wholeheartedly agree.
And, you know, I've had Flutie Nastiness on, I've had Paula on, I've had DeAndre on, they're all fabulous, just amazing. You know, I hadn't seen DeAndre play before I interviewed him, so I got to go out and see him play, and he's just stupid good.
Oh yeah, you know? he's legendary.
It makes me think like he could like eat a sandwich while he plays because he looks so relaxed, and he's playing this ridiculously hard stuff, and he's just like, nah, he's like, meh, relaxed about it. It's stupid. Yeah,
very gifted. I mean, that's what. If you think about it, that's with every great musician, though. Like it looks effortless when they're at work. You know, one of my favorite classical pianists is Vladimir Horowitz, and I just love watching him play because, like, it's like he's having a sip of tea and some crackers at the piano, and he's playing Rachmaninoff's Third like it's nothing. if I look at it like, you know, I'm going to get crossed up. You know, it's going to be hard work for me, but, you know, same thing with DeAndre. Yeah, I agree. He's just so effortless with him.
No, it's great. And he's such a cool guy, just a nice guy. So that always makes you feel good too. So, mm-hmm. Well, Desmond, I appreciate the time. It's a joy to get to talk to you. And like I said, it was so, you made the Christmas tune special. You made it, you know, it's such a nice thing. I'm always, you know, when I didn't give you much, I just like, do what you think is good. You know, here are the chord changes, and you came back and you hit it out of the park. So it's nice to get to talk to you in person, over Zoom. And I'll come out and see you play live, and I'll put in the show notes all the places to follow you.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, keep me updated. You do one of these events, one of these beat things, I want to come and I want to see it. And you'll be like, okay. Who's that old white guy in the back? And you're like, oh, that's the guy that interviewed me on the podcast.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
All right, brother. Have a good day, man. It was a total joy to get to talk to you.
All right. Thank you.
All right, brother. Take care.
Yeah, that sound good, don't it? Good, don't it? Good, don't it?
Desmond Mason, everybody. So great to talk to Desmond. Yes, check him out down in the show notes. You can see how to follow him on various platforms. This is another one of his tunes he's written. It's very cool. So I appreciate the time with Desmond. Hey, next time. You guys know I have a 90s band, right? Well, a part of the 90s band, some of the things that we do is we do an Everclear song. And guess what? I've got Art Alisakis, the founding member of Everclear, guitarist, singer. He's on next week. They are coming to town. They're playing Grinders on Sunday, July 18th. And we're we're going to talk all about that show, which has got Hoobastank, it's got Wheatus, it's got Living Color, man. Freaking Living Color. Haven't seen those guys since they opened up for the Stones on the Steel Wheels tour. So Art was great. We had a great chat. Check it out. That'll be this time next week. Until then, go out, support live music, and we'll talk real soon. Bye-bye.